Here we go. All right. So it is Hanukkah. Today is the first day of Hanukkah. And happy Hanukkah to everyone. Also, this week is Parashas Miketz, which focuses on the rise of Yosef to a position of power. As Yosef is sprung from jail, as he successfully interprets Paro's dreams, Paro and his attendants are duly impressed by Yosef's dream interpreting abilities and his very perspicacious advice about what to do about the imminent years of satiety followed by the years of hunger. And Yosef is appointed as viceroy of Egypt, as well as the manager of all the food stores in Egypt. And seemingly, the parsha is not really tied into Hanukkah, but there are a number of allusions. I'm not going to go through all of them. Some of them are a little bit wordy, or have to do with numerical value, and so on. So, one interesting, somewhat numerically, actually very numerically inclined, but easy to grasp thing that comes up in the parasha is interesting. If you look in a regular chumash, at the end of just about every parasha, it tells you how many verses are in the parasha. That's how you know if you're in for a long parasha that week or a short one. Well, you could just flip through the pages. But you look at the end and it says there's 110 verses or 95 verses or 150 verses and so on at the end of the parasha. Excuse me. So, by the way, just for those who are wondering, I'm officially out of quarantine, but the cough is still hanging around. So, at the end of this parasha, there's a strange thing. In addition to the number of verses in the parasha, it says there are 2,025 letters in the parasha, I believe is what it says, which is a very random thing to say. Like, that's very nice. Since when do we count the number of letters in the parasha? So the commentators, they point out, let me see if I can get this straight, they point out the following. They say that if you take the numerical value of the word ner, ner means a light or a lamp, right? Because we have the Hanukkah lights. So the word ner, which is like for a lamp or a light that one lights on Hanukkah, how many nights of Hanukkah do we have? 8. And so they say if you multiply the numerical value in Hebrew of the word ner, it's 250, because ner is spelled nun resh. The resh is 200. The nun is 50. 200 plus 50, for all you great mathematicians out there, equals 250. Very good. And if you multiply that by 8 nights, you will get the number 2,000. Now, what night of the Jewish month does Hanukkah start? On the 25th day of the month of Kislev. So it's seen as an allusion that on the 25th day of Kislev, we light a ner for 8 nights. Hence, the number 2025 is an allusion to 8 lamps, which is a numerical value of 250 times 8 is 2,000. Beginning on the 25th night, you have 2025. Do what you want with that. It's a nice little thought, and it does explain why in the world the number of letters end up at the end of the parasha. Why did someone along the way see fit to include that? It works out very nicely and neatly. I want to focus on something that really is an idea, an important lesson, especially in today's world. It's an idea that comes up in Hanukkah and also comes up in the parasha with Yosef. And that is the role of externalities. The role of externalities. Because we find that by Hanukkah, there's a lot of people, they portray Hanukkah as being a fight for Jewish independence and so on and so forth. That's really not the truth at all. In fact, the Jewish people, after the miracle of Hanukkah, did not achieve independence for decades afterwards. They continued to fight the Assyrian Greeks for years afterwards. They did not achieve full independence till some 20-some-odd years later, and yet the holiday is celebrated on this particular victory. And the reason is that the victory of the Hanukkah story allowed the Jewish people to practice Judaism unfettered once again, because the Assyrian Greeks had attempted to impose not just their culture, but their religious worldview on the Jewish people. They had basically restricted Jewish practice. Think Soviet Russia, if you want more, and in modern terms, even though Soviet Russia, their religion was no religion, But, you know, today everything's a religion except for religion. So it's, you know, Soviet Russia, the state religion was no religion. And God help you if you tried to practice any sort of a religion in Soviet Russia. And in the Assyrian Greek dominated Judea of the Hanukkah story era, there were serious restrictions put on practicing Judaism. Major tenets of Judaism were banned: no circumcision, no Shabbos observance, no family purity, no Rosh Chodesh, no Torah study. A lot of other persecution, particularly religious persecution, that was going on over there. And at this point, it was because of the religious persecution that the Hasmonaim, the Hasmoneans, rose up in revolt against the Syrian Greek overlords and fought back and succeeded, if not in totally driving them from the land at that point, but at least in restoring their religious freedom at that point. And they're restoring the temple. The temple, initially the Assyrian Greeks made the temple, made the Beis HaMikdash into a temple, I believe, to Zeus or one of the Greek gods. So we have this struggle between the Assyrian Greeks and the Jewish people, not so much over independence, that's not the main focus of the Hanukkah story, but rather over religious practice. And the culture clash that existed between the Jewish people and the Assyrian Greeks is often looked at as religious, you know, worship of the Jewish people, of a tradition going back for millennia, versus an ascendant culture, which, while paying fealty and loyalty to various gods and temples and so on, really was very much focused on the external world, the world of science, the world of beauty, of art, and so on and so forth. There's no question that what the Greeks brought to the world was an appreciation, not just of the scientific method and the scientific world, but of the appreciation of the external world in general, the external natural world, both in terms of playing up the human body, sports, things like the Olympics are come from Greece and from Greek culture, and science as well, the focus on science and so on, also begins with the approach of the Greeks. And the question people often have is, how does Judaism view these ideas? How does Judaism view scientific knowledge over the last number of years? It's been on the forefront with COVID and rejection, and perhaps in some camps of the Jewish world, of certain vaccinations or medical advances or things like that. And it kind of brings the question to the fore: how does Judaism, how does the Torah view scientific advancement, scientific method, at the same time also other external parts of the natural world, beauty, art, and so on? How does Judaism view that? Because people make a mistake and they think that there's a rejection by Torah true Judaism of these ideas. And in fact, that's a terrible error. That's a big mistake. We don't reject science. We don't reject scientific advancement, scientific ideas, scientific methodologies, experimentation, and so on and so forth. Not at all. Judaism does not reject art, beauty, or anything of that sort. Not at all. So that being the case, where exactly does Judaism come to loggerheads with?
Hey, knock it off.
What's that?
Akila, get over here.
Oh, okay. Where exactly? Let me just mute everyone so we don't. Okay, I forgot to mute everyone. There we go. If you have a question, you can unmute. So where exactly is the conflict? Is this integral conflict between the Jewish worldview and the Greek worldview, that these two cultures were on such a collision course with each other that they simply could not abide each other? Excuse me. So I think we can appreciate an answer from the Parsha, from understanding Yosef a little bit. Yosef is the one who becomes the king in this week's Parsha. And if you're paying attention to the Parsha both this week and last week, you will notice that Yosef is someone who very much seems to be focused on externalities. Last week's parasha, the Torah tells us that he was a very good-looking fellow. Rashi says that he groomed himself very nicely. He combed his hair and he dressed the part of a you know, of someone who was in a position of power and importance. Yosef is someone who very much seemed to play up the external world and who very much seemed to pay attention to how he looked. It's, you know, it's fairly clear in the Torah and very clear in the commentators on the Torah that this was something that was a big deal to Yosef. In fact, so much so that the Torah tells us later that Yaakov, in his blessings to Yosef, says that the Egyptian girls and women would actually climb the walls to get a glimpse of Yosef's handsomeness and beauty. Okay, so, you know, millennia before the Beatles showed up, you had girls swooning already, to get a glimpse of Yosef. Now, at the same time, Yosef is the one who does not fall prey to any of these temptations, right? Despite his attractiveness, despite the fact that Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, Yosef withstands that very, very challenging trial. And for those who listen to the recording, I said that on Friday, you know, think about the enormity of the trial he was, of the pressure and of the trial that he had to go through. He's a 17-year-old slave at the mercy of his master's wife. He has very little to lose by giving in because he's been abandoned by his family, sold into slavery, abandoned. He's 17 years old. He's good looking. He's in a position of power. And by refusing her advances, he has quite a bit to lose, which he does lose. He gets thrown into prison. And the only thing anchoring him to withstanding the advances of his master's wife is the knowledge that this is the wrong thing to do. As he says, how can I do this? This is the wrong thing to do, and this will be a sin to God. And so Yosef has nothing but his knowledge of right and wrong to hold him against an enormous pressure, enormous pressure of doing what's right. But simultaneously, we have Yosef over here who seems to be, you know, very much an externalized individual in terms of his good looks and his focus on his mode of dress and how he grooms himself, and yet simultaneously a very, very strong internal moral compass that anchors him and that holds him in place. Okay, we find this again in this week's parasha, this idea, this seeming dichotomy of Yosef, who is, again, so seemingly focused on the external looks. As the Torah tells us, he was dressed in royal robes, and he went out Egypt in this royal carriage. And the Torah goes to great lengths describing, you know, all of the opulence that Yosef enjoyed as the second in command in Egypt. Again, a focus on the external trappings of royalty, of the position of power that he was in. And yet, at the same time, when Yosef has children, he makes it clear that his allegiance and his all the credit for his success goes to God, right? I mean, when he names his children, he discusses how Hashem has helped him in this land of his sojournings and during his difficult times, and how Hashem has helped him see success in a strange and foreign land to which he was sold. When Yosef stands before Paro to interpret his dreams, Paro says, Yosef, I hear you're good at interpreting dreams. And Yosef says, not me. God, on the other hand, is quite good at explaining dreams. So let's see what God has to say. You're standing before the king of Egypt, and this is your big chance to promote yourself and to be able to get out of jail free at this point. And here Yosef's giving some religious talk to the king of Egypt about the fact that it's not me, you know, it's all about God. So Yosef, again, the same idea. Yosef clearly maintains that internal connection to his roots, to his father's house, to God throughout his travails, throughout his challenges, and through the years of his success. While at the same time, we have this focus on the externalities of Yosef's world. And the answer is, how do we resolve these two things? The answer is that when you have an external world, when you have external beauty, and it stops there, that's all you view and all you're able to see is the external beauty. So then that creates corruption. That creates corruption. And an external, superficial, powerful view of something very nice or something very intellectual, might be scientific, might be art, might be music, might be sports, and so on and so forth. If you only success on the external, if you only focus on the externality, you do an experiment and you figure out how the world works. person plumbs the depths of the human body or how it works. I mean, just going through a little bit of the science of COVID and how this virus works and how scientists developed the vaccine for the body to create antibodies based on an mRNA. Don't even ask me exactly how it works, but basically, you know, kind of tricking the body into creating antibodies to fight a virus that the body itself has never yet seen. And you're talking on a microbiological level that is just mind-boggling. So a lot of scientists pat themselves on the back and say, wow, look how far we have come in developing our knowledge and how much we can do in such a short time and how much we've accomplished in fighting this virus. And I think that that is kind of the attitude you hear in much of the world. I don't know. I listen to newscasts and to podcasts about these things. And I was like, wow, it's amazing what modern science can accomplish and what we've discovered and what Mother Nature has in store for us and so on and so forth. And the level of complexity is just mind boggling just in terms of what we know. Forget about what we don't know. This is just the tip of the iceberg. It is just mind boggling. And yet here you have humans who refuse to be humbled in their work and instead are busy parroting how far they've come in terms of what they've been able to do because they've made discoveries in the natural scientific world. Wow, look at everything that we've been able to accomplish. So God turns around and says, aha, so you think you've conquered everything. Okay, well, how about another variant? How about another mutation? How about vaccinations that aren't really effective? How about a third booster, a fourth booster, a fifth booster, you know, and we'll just keep on, you know, every time you think you've beaten it, it comes back. And I think this is just my opinion, that until humanity learns a lesson in humility, this is not going away. and Hashem is going to keep throwing stuff at us until we realize that we really don't have the power to control our own destiny and our own fate. A person who looks at all this external wonderfulness, this external amazing world, all of the complexities, and recognizes that this external, beautiful, amazing, complex, sometimes very challenging world is revealing a depth that is far, far beyond what the superficial surface reveals, that is what Yosef seeks to do. Yosef seeks to use the external to catch your attention. Yosef seeks to use the external to draw the eye and the mind to pay attention. And then when you're paying attention and you're amazed and you're in wonderment and you're impressed, and then he says, okay, look where this is coming from. Look at the source for all this. This doesn't just happen on its own. This is not just an external, superficial, beautiful thing that is just there for you to enjoy, but rather it's meant to reveal a much greater internal reality, which you haven't tapped into yet. And that's what Yosef comes to do. Yosef's external, the trappings, the external trappings of Yosef's world, seek to reveal an internal world that is far, far deeper, far, far greater, and of far, far greater import. And that is what Yosef is looking to do over here, by using the external world to reveal a greater internal world. And that is where the Greek worldview and the Jewish worldview come to loggerheads. So let's move on now from Yosef to the story of Hanukkah. So taking it from Yosef, and you see in the Torah, you see what goes on with Yosef as he talks to Paro, that after Yosef finishes his presentation to Paro, Paro turns to his ministers and he says, have you seen anyone like this in whom the Spirit of God is, with whom the Spirit of God is. Okay. Paro expresses his amazement to the extent that Hashem's spirit, so to speak, is with Yosef. And so Yosef here succeeds through his interpretation of the dream in showing that he's not here on his own. Yosef's skills, his talents are not just here to showboat and showcase what a great, wonderful, talented person he is, but rather it's meant to showcase Hashem's greatness. And that's ultimately Yosef's goal throughout this whole process. Okay, and really, the years of his rule over Egypt, we can't go into all the details right now, but a lot of the years of his rule over Egypt are focused on trying to bring an element of godliness, not the pantheon of pagan gods that the Egyptians worshipped, but some element of godliness of the one true God into Egyptian society to make them realize that there is more to the world than just the external natural world and all of the gods of the natural world that they worship. There's more going on here. And that's his goal, and that's what he's trying to make them realize through that external manifestation of his beauty, of his handsomeness, of all of those external trappings. So when we come to Hanukkah and the whole story, and we come to the Jewish people versus the Greek and the Assyrian Greeks and the entire Greek culture, we meet a similar idea. If we go back to the story of Noach, okay, Noach, after his son Ham does not treat his father properly, Noach gets drunk, he exposes himself, he's exposed in his tent, Ham mistreats his father, there are different opinions exactly what he did to his father, so Noach curses Ham, and then he blesses his other two sons, Shem and Yefes. Shem and Yefes are the ones who cover Noach. It's interesting to note what happens. The Torah tells us that Shem and Yefes, Noach's two sons, they take a blanket, a cover, and they walk in backwards so as not to see their father in his state of disgrace. And they cover him without looking at him at all. They cover him. And Noach blesses Shem and Yefes. What does he say? Excuse me. He says, Yavdalakim liYefes, may Hashem grant beauty to Yefes, the Yishkan Ba'alei Shem, may he dwell in the tents of Shem. So this is seen, again, that's the simple reading of the verse. May God grant beauty, Yavdalakim, Yavd is the word Yefes, Yafe. Yafe in Hebrew means beautiful. Yavdalakim liYefes, but may he dwell in the tents of Shem. Some interpret the verse as saying as follows. The Yishkan Ba'alei Shem, the verse can be read as follows. May God grant beauty to Yefes, and may that beauty dwell in the tents of Shem. And the idea is that the beauty of Yefes is the progenitor, he is the ancestor of the Greek nation. A lot of other nations as well. Persia comes down from Yefes. But Greece is looked at as the primary descendant. It's discussed over there when the Torah talks about the many descendants and children of these three sons, the many descendants who comprise the 70 basic nations of the world. So Yavon, which is Greece, is among the descendants of Yefes. That beauty of Yefes resides in the tents of Shem. And there's a lot of different interpretations of what's going on, but on a basic level, the idea is this. Here's the idea. Shem is, by the way, the word shame is the root of the term Semite. So if someone's an anti-Semite, doesn't mean he dislikes Jews, means he dislikes descendants of Shem, period. Shem is the son of Noach, and the term anti-Semitic actually comes from there. Someone who is against Shem. But both Shem and Yefes have the sensitivity to cover Noach in his state of disgrace. The commentators point out, however, that they had a different motive. They had a different motive. And Rashi tells us that Shem was rewarded by covering his father, for covering his father with a garment, by putting a garment over his father to cover his father's disgrace, his father's lack of clothing. Shem is rewarded with tzitzis. Okay? Tzitzis is a mitzvah to put the strings on the corner of the garment. Yefes is rewarded that in the future, in the final apocalyptic battle, on the dawn of the Messianic era, so the descendants of Yefes will be defeated, and their bodies will merit burial. Their bodies will merit to be buried. Okay, what's the idea? What is the idea? The idea is this: Yefes's focus is on the external. What's the external? The body. Why did Yefes cover his father? Because Yefes said it's a disgrace for the body to be exposed this way. It's not nice. the external human body should be covered. It's disgraceful for it to be exposed. Shame sees a deeper idea. Shame sees that there's a spiritual content beneath the body. And when the body is exposed, so then that is demeaning to the soul of the person. The body is meant to reflect the soul. And when the body is exposed, all you see is a physical external body. You lose sight of the soul. The idea of wearing clothing on a deeper level is that it allows you to see the spiritual content of the person instead of just the physical content of the person, something which is very lost in today's world and explains a lot of things. Okay? That, you know, you have this idea today of body shaming and all this stuff. That comes from a culture of that I am my physical body. And the more a person identifies with his or her physical body, the more sensitive they are about it. Whereas if I recognize that, no, my primary identity is my spiritual side, so then the clothing are meant to reflect what I truly am. And then my body is much less important in terms of its own identity, but rather it becomes, it's supposed to be a vehicle to express the spiritual content. Shame recognizes the spiritual content the body is meant to reflect. And he says, that's why it's vital to cover the body. Yefet says the body has to be covered because the body has to be covered. It's just not nice for the body to be exposed. Yefet's focus on the body means that at a later point, that body will merit burial in the ground instead of being left to rot on the field. Just the body, the shell, sans any life. Shame, however, who recognizes the holiness of the human, he recognizes that clothing is meant to express the spiritual power that's buried within. The body is meant to express the spiritual power that is within. And that's why he covers his father. He's rewarded with a spiritual commandment. Your clothing will now be a mitzvah. It's going to have spiritual power to it. You put strings on your four-corner garment. You have a mitzvah tzitzis, and that will express a mitzvah now. Seemingly a very physical endeavor, clothing, a very physical thing, is now going to express a mitzvah because that clothing is meant to reveal something much deeper. And so the conflict between the descendants of shame and the descendants of Yefes are around this very point. Do I look at the external world as an end all? This is it. I have a world. I see it. And, you know, I'll conduct experiments. I'll come to my conclusions. I'll tell you how everything in the universe works. I'll tell you how black holes form. I'll tell you how many years ago the universe was formed, whether it's going outwards, whether it's contracting inwards, how fast light moves, how much space gets bent. I'll look inwards and I'll tell you how cells work and how viruses work and how the human body works on a enormously complex level, down on a very, very, very down to the smallest micro levels, and I'll be able to explain everything and tell you how it works and figure it all out and conquer it, so I think. And that's it. It starts and ends there. It's wonderful. It's complex. It's beautiful. It's great, but it starts and it ends there, and that's it. And there's nothing else to focus on besides that external world that I can look at, that I can gape at, that I can poke and prod and test. That is the worldview of the Assyrian Greeks. That is the worldview of Yefes. The Jewish people come along and say, it's all wonderful. It's wonderful. It's great. It's beautiful. But it's meant to reveal something much, much bigger. And the Greeks go crazy from this. What do you mean it's meant to reveal something bigger? This is it. Just, you have a world. Figure it out. Conquer it. Revel in it. Enjoy it. Display it. Celebrate it. And that's it. That is the sum total of life. And here we have this loggerheads of the Assyrian Greeks, of the Greek culture, that's saying everything starts and ends with the external world. It's beautiful. It's great. It's wonderful. And there's nothing more to talk about. And the Jewish people who say science is wonderful. You can do all the experiments you want. We can pontificate about all the philosophical conundrums you would like and have long and very deep discussions about them. But if when you're done, all you're left with are just very deep philosophical conundrums, and it doesn't really take you anywhere, it doesn't expose a deeper reality of what you are supposed to be doing in this world, of what the purpose of the world is, of what is creating this world and where everything is coming from, then you've absolutely missed the boat. You've wasted your chance and the opportunity to live life properly. The Greeks can't stand that. They can't stand that idea. You want me to take this beauty and dig deeper? You want me to understand it on a deeper level and see what it's meant to reveal. Are you crazy? What are you talking about? That's it. This is all there is. What you see is what you get. And the Jewish people come and say, no, we've got a whole Torah. And we've got lots of mitzvos that are meant to come into this physical world. And we're meant to engage in them and live a life in this physical world, part of the physical world, understanding the physical world, but bringing out a depth that is much, much greater than the external, than the externalities that you see. So that is the source, or a major source, of the conflict between the Jewish people and the Assyrian Greek culture. Excuse me again. So that is where the miracle of Hanukkah comes into the picture. And that is why we have, if you look at the prayer of Al HaNisim that we say on Hanukkah, we say that Hashem gave over the mighty into the hands of the weak, and the many into the hands of the few, and so on and so forth. What's the big focus specifically when it comes to Hanukkah about that idea? We don't find that idea by Pesach. We don't find it by Purim. Specifically by Hanukkah, we praise Hashem that you gave over the mighty into the hands of the weak and the many into the hands of the few, and so on and so forth. What is the idea behind it? So one idea is that the nature of the miracle that took place, at least in the battle between the Jewish people and the Assyrian Greeks, is that you're talking about a ragtag bunch of guerrillas taking on the world's mightiest army at that time. Okay. Naturally, if you would assess this based on the natural cause and effect of the world, how the world normally runs, there was no reason that the Jewish people ought to be victorious. Okay. Yes, you'll give me all sorts of ideas and pontifications about how they won and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is that naturally it really didn't make very much sense. And the point is that when you have a hang on one second. I'll take a question in a minute. When you have a worldview that things just run based on the natural world, there's cause and effect, I figured out how things work, then you're right, it makes sense. If I have a very mighty army, they ought to easily be able to crush a small ragtag group of Jewish, basically priests who took up arms to fight against the Assyrian Greeks. And you're right. But it's when the Jewish people say we're not looking at the natural cause and effect, because if we look at the natural cause and effect, that is what the Greeks want us to do. That's what Greek culture says. That's what the Greek worldview says. But Torah says that while we see an external world, it's meant to reveal a much deeper reality that Hashem is in charge. And it's through that idea and through that willingness to go and fight, even though naturally it made no sense, that's when Hashem says, okay, you've tapped into that reality that there's something more than just the natural world. So then I'm going to come through for you, and I'm going to show you that indeed things are not going to run according to the natural course of events. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think you may have just answered my question, but I would like to point out that the examples that you gave,
you're not coming through very, very clearly.
Exodus and Purim, those are also a very small group of people. Oh.
You try again, because I'm not hearing you very well.
Is this any better?
Yes.
Okay, so I said that you may have answered the question, but I would like to point out that the examples that you gave about Purim and the Exodus are also about a small group prevailing over a large group against all odds.
Right, but we don't make a focus out of it. You're right, but that's not the focus over there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the point, that over here by Hanukkah specifically, where we're looking to tap into that idea that every holiday is obviously a revelation of God's power and might, but each holiday has its own unique revelation of what aspect of God's greatness and his running of the world that we're focusing on. In the case of Hanukkah, I believe it's specifically this idea that there's a natural world, but that natural world is meant to reveal something much deeper and much greater. So in this case, it's really the only holiday where the Jewish people actually went to war, a full-fledged regular battle. Yes, by Purim, they did fight their enemies, but that wasn't the main focus of the miracle. The main focus of the miracle was the fact that they were able to turn things around on its head, Whereas a Hanukkah, the major focus, the miracle, was within the battle itself. You did have to take up arms. You had to go through a natural course of action to be victorious. But that natural course itself was unnatural. It didn't make any sense for them to win. So it was that, okay, we have to take that natural course of events, even though naturally it doesn't make any sense for us to do it. But we have to have faith that there's something more than just the regular cause and effect that the world likes to see. Okay. So those are some thoughts to think about over Hanukkah. And if you think about it, really, just conclude with a thought. We use oil. The word in Hebrew for oil is shemen. Shemen is cognate with the word shamin. Shamin means fat. Okay. And the idea is something which is fatty tends to move beyond its boundaries. Okay. Something which is fatty is something which is larger than the container that holds it, in a sense. And it also is cognate with the word shmone, which means eight, because the number seven is always the expression of the natural world. We've talked about this a lot of times. 7 days in the week, seven notes on the musical scale, seven colors in the rainbow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The natural world is seven. Eight is the number that moves beyond the natural world. It expands beyond the package. So I have a natural world of seven. When that package of the natural world reveals something greater than itself, when it bulges outwards, in, shall we say, shumming, in a way that fat would push the package outwards, then you see that this natural package really is containing something much more than meets the eye externally. Okay? And so that is the focus on shemen, on oil, which also broke the natural rules. The Jewish people light the menorah. Naturally, it should last for one night. And miraculously, it lasts for 8 days. Again, the natural rules going haywire, because the Jewish people said, well, it doesn't make any sense, but we have to put in our effort. We'll do what we can, and we will look inwards for God to assist us and to reveal something more than what we see. All we see here is one day's worth of oil. But miraculously, this oil is going to expand past its abilities and burn for 8 days. That's an idea to think about as we move through Hanukkah, that we do engage the world. We do look at the external world, but we ought to use it as a means to see that which is pushing out and struggling to show its existence and its presence in our natural world. All right, we'll stop here. I wish everyone a very happy Hanukkah, and have a wonderful week. Take care.